This is the Living Legacy Project interview with Ron Emke on August 17th, 2012. Ron, what inspired you to want to be an artist?
Well, you know, some of the very first associations I have with art are watching the Johnny Carson show, the Ed Sullivan show, Carol Burnett show a little bit later, and just being caught up in this, you know, kind of show busy world. And I'm the kind of person who doesn't draw a distinction between art and showbiz. I mean, they're all art is showbiz in a sense, and showbiz is an art, definitely. And around the same time that I was watching those TV shows, my mother was involved in community theater, and so I got a chance to see backstage people with these weird things, like I remember, you know, women with glitter on their eyes, you know, eyeshadow and things like that, and it just seems, and then, you know, you don't notice those things from the seats, the weirdness of the makeup, and so it just, it seemed surreal. It was like an early kind of encounter with surrealism for me, but also realism, and also just the magic and the illusion of again, showbiz. And so that just all seemed so incredibly romantic to me at a very early age. And then, so I had one sense of what art was or what, you know, entertainment was. Then I went to college, and on one of my first weeks in school, I saw Godard's movie Weekend, and I almost walked out on it. I thought it was one of the worst things I'd ever seen coming. It was challenging everything that I knew and believed, and it's not like I hadn't seen, you know, Altman movies and Woody Allen movies and some, you know, Bergman, some artsy-fartsy kind of things. But this Weekend just really disturbed me in a way, because I just thought that, you know, that's not a movie. How can you, you know, put the camera in the middle of a barnyard and just turn it around 360 degrees in slow motion? I mean, this is agonizing. And by the very next day when I woke up, I thought, I went from thinking that was the worst movie I'd ever seen to the best movie I'd ever seen. And this was in the heyday in the late 70s of punk rock and the post-punk movement. And around the same time that I discovered Godard, I discovered bands like The Clash and especially the Gang of Four, who, first of all, made really catchy music, but also had something to say. So it's like they wanted, first of all, to both of those bands wanted to really question all of the stuff about, you know, the glittery eyes and all the showbiz trappings, and to really make statements, I guess, with their music. And that sounds really tedious, but it wasn't to me. It was really thrilling. And so Godard's politics and the Gang of Four and the Clash's politics kind of merged in my head with this image of, you know, like the flashy kind of thing. And it just, finding ways to combine those two things became, you know, a real goal for me.
Where did you go to school? Where did you go for your college education?
Well, for college, I went to Rice University in Houston, Texas. And I was one of the lone liberal arts students in a field of, you know, science and engineering types. And this was kind of valuable because it was, I'm kind of used to being the outsider in any group. Like, for instance, I'm assuming that a lot of the people that are in this, and I know now that a lot of people in this target, you know, in this program are visual artists, and I'm just not one. I wish I was in a certain way, but I'm just not. And I became really comfortable with the advantages of being an outsider. It's kind of the same thing of living in Buffalo as opposed to living in a flashier city like New York City. You can do certain things when you're on the margins that you can't do, or you can't do as easily if you live, you know, in the sexy hub of everything. And so Rice was an early example of that, because I was able to, I had ideas for plays that I wanted to put on and performances, and I was able to do it really easily because nobody else was doing that. There was zero competition, you know, for, it wasn't like, oh, I want to, you know, write this play about the U.S.'s involvement in El Salvador and stage it. And, you know, and there was no one saying, oh, that's great, but you'll have to, you know, fill out an application, do a proposal and all that. It's just, okay, great. Well, we got these, you know, we have these days open for rehearsal and for the performance, and there's no charge for any of this because it's a, you know, there's no competition. it's an open field. You know, when you ask about school, I have to put in a word, I think, for a program that I was involved in between the ages of, I want to say, 12 and 16 or so. The state of Louisiana, where I'm from, had a summer program called the Governor's Program for Gifted Children. And this, again, attracted lots of bright science and engineering and mathematics kids. And that's the kind of things in philosophy, or those are the kind of things we studied in the morning. But in the afternoon, we took amazing classes in. We staged, you know, full-length. We only had 6 weeks to do this. We staged full-length musicals and kind of classic plays. And it was such an incredible education in theater craft, in theater history, the kinds of things that were just really useful. So I learned more about the craftsmanship behind the sparkly eyes and the community theater kind of world. And then there were other people who were really ambitious and did kind of their own projects. And I learned from all of that. And that was just, of all the education that I've had, that was the experience at exactly the right age that just, you know, made it really clear to me what I wanted to do, you know, with language, with theater, with all of those kinds of things.
That sounds like an incredibly progressive program.
Oh, it was wonderful. It was absolutely terrific.
When you went to Houston, what was your major?
English. I was a psychology major for one semester, and the psychology teacher told us on the day that we were studying drugs, he told us that Eric Clapton's nickname was Slow Hand because drugs had destroyed his ability to play the guitar. And so I just thought, I can't take this. And so the guy was an awful teacher, no offense to the poor man, but I had at the same time really wonderful English teachers. And literature was always, you know, where my heart was. The psychology major thing was actually kind of originally a concession to my parents, who wanted to make sure that I would have some kind of stable job. And they always said, well, you know, you could write on the side if you want. There are lots of psychologists who write books and so forth. And so I thought, well, that makes sense. I should have this really stable, you know, professional job, and then I can have this kind of hobby. And then I just realized, well, that's ridiculous. My heart isn't in this, you know, stable thing. It's in the writing. It's in the words, the language. So I should just eliminate. This other thing isn't really working for me. So I'd rather put my time and energy into being the best I can at reading and writing, I guess, and leave the other stuff to people whose heart is more in it.
When you were in Houston, did you have any influential professors who really helped you continue to determine your creative path?
Oh, I certainly did. There was, in the English department alone, there was a guy, Terry Duty, who was just a really gifted teacher, really made, you know, literature come alive. Later on, there was someone, and he's actually the guy who got me to come to Buffalo, a professor named Ed Snow, who was kind of an eccentric teacher, had kind of eccentric methods, and was also very much interested in connections between visual art and literature. So, for instance, in an ostensibly an English class, we studied Vermeer at length. We looked at connections between Vermeer's work and poetry. We tried to, you know, to write about his work, to put into words what we were seeing, you know, on the canvas, which was a tremendous experience. Then there were a couple of professors in the media study department. I say I was an English major, but I really spent most of my time in the media study department. That was the beginning of something that I've done my whole life, which is declare myself one thing but be interested in about seven other things and spend more of my time, you know, in with those other things in those other departments. I'm not a specialist at all. I'm totally a generalist. But Brian Huberman was just this crazy guy who is a British guy, just completely obsessed with the Alamo and with the Western. And it was. I mean, you always hear about Europeans' fascination with the Wild West and with myths of America. And he was embodying this in a certain way, but he was also very invested in social documentary. And there's a very strong connection between the Rice Media Center and the media studies program at Buffalo. People like James Blue, who I never knew, Jerry O'Grady and others. There was a lot of contact, which is kind of how I ended up at UB. It was actually Ed Snow that recommended. He had been to both Rice and UB, and he said, you know, knowing you, the person that the place that you should really go to if you're interested in being an English major, an English grad student, is UB, because they have this really kind of visionary free-form department, and I think you'd really like it there. And he was sort of right, sort of wrong. The other professor in the media study department who was really influential was Thomas McEvely, who made quite a name for himself as an art theorist in the 80s and 90s. He also was quite the character, kind of establishing this tradition. I've kind of noticed that media study departments around the country tend to attract these people who are total characters, and that really appeals to me in a way. And, you know, come to think about it, I'm just realizing this right now, I think a lot of what the appeal is that for them, art exists outside of just, you know, in the case of media study, the screen. You come into a movie theater, you watch a movie, and that's the art. I mean, the kinds of people that I have in mind, and they're not just at Rice. I see them in sort of the glory days of the media study program at UB. I see them here at Buff State. They're really invested in their community in a much, much broader way than, say, your average, and again, your average English professor, or, you know, even a sociologist is, because the lines between career and life and community are much, much thinner, if they exist at all.
Absolutely. I completely agree.
You were asking about influences?
Yes, I'm talking about influences.
Yeah.
Do you want to...
Well, I'm thinking of two that are a little earlier.
Mm-hmm. Please.
One is my mother, who is the complete inspiration for this character that I've invented called Rana Wanda, who's kind of an MC character. My mother not only was involved in community theater, but she was actually, although she would never use this term, and the term didn't really exist at the time, she was a performance artist in her own right, because she would stage these incredible... they're basically performance pieces with members of the church. I think it was called the Ladies Auxiliary. They would do these fundraisers, and she would stage these fashion shows that were parodies of fashion shows. And although I don't know that she would really identify herself as a feminist, she was absolutely a feminist performance artist of a type. Somewhat like Padalecki, who is doing things using costumes to kind of spoof the society at large. And these shows were very funny. She would MC them. I learned everything I know about, you know, how to MC an event through watching her, and watching her just completely be herself. She could put on the craziest of costumes, but just be herself, be honest with herself and with the audience in a way that... was just really fun to watch and really empowering. Her own role models, she would be the first to say, were Minnie Pearl, who is known to people these days through shows like Hee Haw, and she was a staple on the Grand Ole Opry. Minnie Pearl's trademark was wearing wigs and clothes and things and leaving the price tags on them, which is something that I've been doing as kind of a tribute to my mother and to Minnie Pearl ever since. And then Phyllis Diller was another. I mean, in my mother's day, there weren't really that many women comics, and the ones that existed tended to be pretty self-deprecating. And so that's, you know, not a really great option for a woman in any in the... Even by the early 60s and by the early 70s in Lake Charles, Louisiana, which is about 10 years behind the rest of the culture, that wasn't so inspiring. So my mother would take this kind of absurdist route, sort of like Phyllis Diller would, and not unlike Phyllis Diller and Minnie Pearl, she had this kind of... Today she'd be called a drag queen, I think, because she's a woman who... looks like, or would create a performance persona, was like a woman performing as a man, pretending to be a woman. So these, you know, there were just these layers going on. And my mother didn't put a whole lot of thought into any of this. It was just what was funny to her and what was funny to audiences. But I was, you know, completely, I wasn't really making notes about all this at the time, but it absolutely influenced a certain strain of work that I did many, many years later. Another huge influence on me was the first collaborator that I had, a friend of mine, James Bergeron, who was about 2 years older than me, but definitely felt like a mentor, although he used to say that I felt like a mentor to him, I guess you could say. So it was, it was a good relationship. But James was really invested in collaboration and felt, and this was in the late 70s, and again, this idea was starting to take root. Now, it doesn't sound so bizarre to talk about collaboration. I mean, everybody's doing it. It's the hot, trendy thing to do. But in the late 70s, I think we were still caught up in this notion of, this romantic notion of the misunderstood artist who works alone against the world. And, you have the heroic artist figure with the little people behind him. It's going to be a him, always. I think women really brought the whole tradition of collaboration, or the women's movement really brought this notion of collaboration, non-hierarchical organization, into the foreground around this time period. And it took a while to catch on in the arts. So we wrote collectively, we performed collectively, we formed a group called Zoot Friends, which started out as Zoo Friends until the zoo in Houston threatened to sue us for taking their name. But we used ourselves as the performers. We started out trying to write conventional plays that had other performers in them, but we had a lot of trouble getting other people to do. We tried using people from the theater community to do the kind of work that we wanted to do, and It was tricky. It was hard getting them to do it because theater people are very used to, particularly in that day, give me the script, tell me the story, and I will do it for you. I will, invest some of myself in it. And what we kept saying, the more of these productions we did, the more we kept saying, well, just use yourself as the basis for this. We're not creating a character that we have, solidly in line. We want you to just use your own experience as the core. And it just got to be too hard to find other people who could do that. So we started becoming kind of reluctantly the performers in these productions ourselves. So I think I was trying to be part of that world with the community theater model and all of that, the showbizy kind of model, but it wasn't working because the other side of me, the side that was kind of rooted in the Gang of Four and the Clash, who are speaking from their own experience, it was just too hard to get those two things to jive. And so so we ended up performing in the productions that we did. And then what started happening was people would come to our shows and like them a lot and want to be involved in them. And so we started recruiting audience members to become members of the company, which was it felt really exciting. It felt like a form of audience participation that was much more long-term than just going into some place and making the poor people in the audience do silly things, for an hour or so. It was like having them do silly things for years.
Talk about community theater or something like this is drawing real the community
yeah,
into mm-hmm. alternative theater. That's really
yeah, incredible. exactly. Yeah. While I was at Rice, I think the last year I was there, Laurie Anderson came to town. She had just had. She wasn't known so much as a performance artist in a place like Houston. There was no real performance art. That term. There was a show at the Contemporary Art Museum that was looking at contemporary performance art, and it included people like Joan Jonas. I'm trying to think of who else. I want to say Trisha Brown, but I'm not sure about that. Colette, some other people. It's possible that Robert Wilson was even part of that. It was a stellar group, but James and I didn't really care for most of what we saw in that show. It was a lot of kind of high New York City, late 70s Soho performance stuff, and it didn't really speak to us in any particular way. And then Laurie Anderson came to Rice to do a one-night thing. Not so much, I mean, she was booked as I think on the strength of her college radio hit single, Oh Superman. And so I think we were all coming to see that, and then we got to see this incredible show instead, and just doing the most innovative things with the simplest of technology. It seemed kind of high tech at the time, but in reality, I think she was using things like overhead projectors and slide projectors, and the technology wasn't really all that advanced, but she had this gift for looking at those tools in completely new ways, which was so incredibly exciting. And that just became this just tremendous inspiration. And it was just, you know, it was so exciting because she did something that I had been wanting to see happen for a long time, which was to take the energy of theater and the energy of rock music, of a rock concert, the theater of a rock concert, and put those two things together. Because the typical rock concert, there's inherent theater. When I've taught classes about performance, I almost always start with rock concerts because I think those, and I'm talking before the, you know, Lady Gaga era of, or Marilyn Manson or whatever, the of staging. I just mean, just any basic concert is filled with this kind of theatrical anticipation, like, you know, when's the band going to come out? What are they going to look like if you haven't seen them before? You know, what are they going to play? And they, and a good rock show is structured like a good play is. But I wasn't seeing too many people playing with that kind of stuff at the time. Certainly not from the theater side of things, which, I mean, Laurie Anderson, you can't categorize her as any one thing. She was doing all of the stuff at the same time, which was also inspirational to me, that she could do a lot of different things, do a little bit of a lot of different things.
Around what year was that when she came to?
It must have been 82, like early 82, because I came to Buffalo right after that for grad school in the fall of 82. And interestingly enough, one of the first things that I saw in Buffalo was a performance by Tony Conrad, which was at, in those days, the art department of UB was in Bethune Hall, which was this funky 3 or 4 story factory with giant elevators, and just, it was like the quintessential artist's loft kind of thing. There was a funkiness about it that you just can't find in a more conventional, you know, build academic building. They're just amazing things there.
And that building was downtown?
Well, it was North Buffalo, okay. I guess I would say. It was near, well, I lived just a couple of blocks away from there. It was, I'm trying to think of what it was near. It's, you know, a good 5 or 6 blocks away from the Main Street campus of UB.
Do you remember what piece by Conrad you saw? What it was?
Well,
what you thought about it?
Well, I'm trying to think. Oh, yeah. I can tell you what I thought about it right away was, which was, this is the first thing I've seen other than the Laurie Anderson performance that really speaks to me, that excites me in a way as an audience member, and that inspires me as a maker of performance events. I don't know what the title of it was, but I do know that it, this was before Tony was kind of reinventing his minimalist music series. This was much more about, this was, well, I can't really call it conventional performance, but it was more performance, it was a, yeah, it's really, Tony unfortunately has as much trouble describing these things as I do, so I don't feel so silly trying to put a name on this. I'm trying to find a way to tell you that he had us, the entire audience, sing the song I'm a Friend of Tony Conrad together. And it had a little bit of a, I don't think this was conscious at all, but it had a little bit of a Pee-wee's Playhouse children's show, like it was almost like a children's show for extremely smart but extremely dysfunctional children, and he treated us that way, kind of as children, and had us sing this very childlike song. I want to say, and I could have added this to the performance, but I could swear that there was a scene while we were singing to him, he was sitting, if not on a toilet, something that looked like a toilet, a chair, going through looking at film, and the film seemed to be kind of coming out of his butt. I mean, there's really no other way to describe this, so that you kind of got the sense of film as just this, you know, sort of excremental material. Now, you could probably ask Tony about this, and he could say, none of that was in there. You dreamed all of that, which is entirely possible. But I remember the song, and I remember this kind of just joyous feeling, creepy and joyous at the same time. Creepy for kind of obvious reasons, but joyous because it was about the joy of creation in a certain way. And I just thought it just completely blew me away. I loved it. A few years later, I had him as a guest speaker in a class that I was teaching on performance. And he did an equally astonishing thing in which he took this huge length of parachute fabric, the kind of stuff that he used in later of his early minimalist performances. He told the class about how artists have bags of tricks, and he produced in his bag of tricks this gigantic amount of fabric, and then started encompassing the audience / the class in the fabric, so that eventually everybody was... It's possible that not everyone was wrapped in. Some people were wrapped in and some people were excluded. While he's telling this, one of his, you know, classic Tony Conrad long meandering stories, and your mind is engaged in working out what his words are telling you, and meanwhile you're experiencing just being encased in fabric with a bunch of other people that are, you know, your fellow students, and so you feel the certain closeness to them, but also a certain distance from them, because the only thing that brings you together is the fact that you're in a class together. And so it was just another one of these moments of balancing kind of joy and creepiness. In subsequent years, I've really seen the way that Tony has influenced an entire generation of, well, several generations of students. When I first came to town, Paul Sheritz was still alive and was still teaching, and Tony Conrad was there, and for a very brief period, Hollis Frampton was still alive and still teaching. Frampton, I only got to know after he died through an incredible show of his at the Albright Knox, and came to realize that, I mean, he's just stunningly, he was just this stunning talent on so many levels. But the department in the kind of early 80s tended to attract two kinds of students, the ones that gravitated to Paul Sheritz and the ones that gravitated to Tony Conrad. You could almost say there were the Apollonian ones who went to Tony, who, you know, were kind of intrigued, who were engaged intellectually with things and who could work on this balance of joy and creepiness in their own way. And the Dionysian ones who gravitated to Paul Sheritz and tended to be to kind of live the ideals of punk rock on a daily basis, who thrived on these wild stories about Paul's behavior and who would try to emulate that in their own lives. So it was just fascinating as an outsider, because again, I wasn't in that department, but just to kind of watch, you know, year after year of students coming in and gravitating to one or the other of these kind of two polar opposites. They probably wouldn't say they were as opposite as I thought they were, but it was like these two models for ways to be an artist.
Ron, could you please talk about your art, what you create, and why you create it?
Oh, God. Well, I really don't like answering... I don't know, the word art makes me uncomfortable, I think, because it makes so many people in our culture uncomfortable, because they have all these crazy notions about... Some artists have these crazy notions, but mostly people in the general community have these, you know, odd notions about what an artist is. And so I don't want to appear odd to people, I guess. So I sometimes will just say that I'm basically at heart a storyteller or a fiction writer, even though not everything I do is written down. And what I like about the term fiction is that it implies this certain craft. It's not about whether something is true or false, whether something really happened or didn't really happen. It's about something being, well, it is about being true, I think, but it's also about being crafted and sculpted in a certain way. So in my life, that can take the form of writing, you know, for the page, or doing live performances, or making videotapes. I did 100 episodes of a cable access TV show with Richard Wicca called Snap Judgments, in which we reviewed movies that we had not seen based on everything but the movie itself, the marketing of the movie, our gut feelings, who was in it, all that kind of thing. And then, I think things have taken other forms as well, but those are the main ones.
Can you talk about the totality of your body of work and some of the different themes that have emerged within it?
Strangely, I can. I like to say that almost everything I do has to do with the relationships between art and money, although that's not always true anymore. I think sometimes that's an explicit theme and sometimes that's a sub-theme. The sense that art is a form of work, which isn't necessarily taken seriously by people who do things that are more conventionally considered work. And I wrestle with this all the time about whether, you know, there was a movement for a while to refer to artists as culture workers, to kind of have their work taken seriously in the same way, even if it's only taken seriously by themselves. In my life, I noticed that performers, bands, performance artists, media artists, etc., are always getting hit up to do benefits for all kinds of causes, which is great. I think that's a really wonderful thing. But the thing is, there's never any thought to paying, or seldom any thought to paying the artists. But if you try to get someone who runs the lights or does the sound or something like that to do it for free, I mean, you just don't even think about it. That's automatically a budget item. And I think the deeper implication is that that's real work, and that what artists do is really some fun hobby that, you know, they can kind of contribute on the side, that it's not work. And I like not resolving that question in any way. I have an entire performance that's about asking this question and not really answer it, not being able to really answer it. Other totality things. Now, one thing that connects almost everything that I do is that it's collaborative. I don't have a single style. I don't have a single aesthetic, a single message. I mean, I talked about the art and money thing, and that does recur, but I collaborate with other people all the time, and so I'm kind of seeing what it is that the two of us or three or 12 of us can do as a group, and working from that rather than, you know, bringing a particular thing to the table.
Can you talk about your creative process?
Yes, I can. If Eureka, the two different processes. If I'm working by myself and if I'm working with other people. If I'm working by myself, there's an enormous amount of procrastination that goes into every project. Doing everything under the sun except working on the project, which is all kind of like stewing. I think part of it is the one way to describe that is, you know, oh, the ideas are stewing and they're germinating. And the other side of that is that I'm getting this level of anxiety built up in myself that I feel like, okay, I can't, I've got to do this now. I can't put it off any longer. Now, if I'm working with other people, it's a completely different process. I love collaborating with other people. I always have. And I think part of it's so much easier to do most of the time, 99% of the time, it's so much easier to do. And part of that is just having a sense of who the other person or people are, what they're good at, why they want to work with me, what they want to get out, what I can contribute, what they can contribute. And then from there, I very seldom, if we're having planning meetings about a performance or a videotape or something, I very seldom come to the table saying, I want to make, you know, a 5-minute long videotape about this, this, and this, or I want the performance, in the performance I intend to, you know, say this, do this, dress this way, etc. I just don't do that. I come with pretty much nothing. I feed off of the ideas of the other people. I am very excited about making connections between other people and between people and ideas and other ideas, people and other people. And so I just kind of come with nothing prepared and feed off of the energy of the room, I guess you could say, and try to find as much fun as possible. You know, I could spend the entire interview talking about mentors and influences and so forth, because there have been so many of them. There's a Japanese performance artist / choreographer named Yoshiko Chuma, who came to Hall Walls back in the mid-80s, And then I kind of stayed in touch with her over the years. We did many projects together, and she has a way of saying that you should always try to do the easy thing. Like, instead of, and she was referring, everything that Yoshiko says has a kind of double meaning, it seems like. Like, it can be related to the project at hand, but it can also be a sort of life lesson. And she's talking specifically in terms of movement, physical movement. She's working with dancers. And instead of trying to do a movement that's just going to, you know, break your back and sprain your ankle and everything else, do the easy thing. So Yoshiko would always say to do the easy thing, and she didn't mean... What she meant, you know, don't do the movement that is, you know, like breathtakingly difficult and that's going to result in physical injury. Just do the simple movements. She kind of came out of the pedestrian movement school of the Judson Church and other, choreographers of the early 70s. She had her own particular spin on that was just, you know, easy movement. And, I think that's a perfectly good goal in life, to try to find the easy way to do things. And that's part of the appeal of collaboration for me, is to look for the easy thing that you can do. If you have 12 people working together and each one does their favorite thing, instead of, like, it's good if you kind of, you know, inspire each other to do more difficult things together collectively. But if you each do something that you love doing, then I think that the end result is going to be something that an audience is going to love seeing.
So here's another broad question for you. What do you hope that the audience takes away from your works?
When you ask it, I think salt and pepper shakers, any of the silverware that happens to be around.
Or another way of saying that is, what do you hope to achieve with your art? I don't like phrasing it like that.
Right, right. Well, what I really like is, and I've said this about 7 times already, but what I really like is connections, connecting people. There's something really powerful to me about, in this particular day and age that we live in, bringing people who don't know each other together in a room for a certain period of time, say an hour, say, you know, could be in some cases 4 or 5 hours, whatever it is, or maybe it's just 15 minutes, but sharing the experience together and making connections. Maybe they meet people that they haven't met before that's peripheral to whatever the performance is. Maybe it's planting ideas that, you know, that register in people's own lives that they can take away something, or just make a connection. Again, connections between people, connections between ideas and people.
So you moved to Buffalo in the early 80s?
Mm-hmm.
And you came here to pursue a master's degree in English at UB.
Well, a PhD I came to pursue, and then I pursued it for a while, and then it eluded my grasp, and so I ended up pursuing an MA instead.
Along your trajectory as a performance artist and a writer, what are some of the things you have had to do to advance your career as a creative type?
Sorry, I just keep thinking of the worst possible AJ-like answers to these questions, but I had to whore myself, honey. It was horrible. It was absolutely horrible. The whole year, all the years of heroin were pathetic. It was painful. And yet I got a lot of sleep, so it wasn't so bad. No, I don't know. What was the question again?
Well, the question was, what have you had to do to advance your career in the arts?
I wish I had done things to advance my career in the arts. I don't feel like I really have done that much to promote myself as an artist at all. Every time I try to do something like that, it doesn't seem to work out. It works out much better if I just kind of live my life, and then eventually people come to me and say, hey, would you like to do a performance, or would you like to write this essay or whatever? I've never been very good at the hard sell. In a way, I wish I was that kind of person, but I don't generally like that kind of person, so it has never really been a career goal of mine. So as a result, you know, we were talking earlier about the career over the long haul, as opposed to being the next Matthew Barney or something. Like, I don't have any regrets. Well, of course, I'm riddled with regrets and, you know, kept awake at night all the time about this. But in reality, no, I don't like that kind of artist that is all about their career, that's so driven by, you know, making work and getting it out there to an audience. Or they're not even interested in getting it out to an audience. They want to get it out to the gatekeepers who will get it out to an audience. And so you're constantly, you know, you're doing this grant so that you can get that grant, so that you can perform in this space, so that you can get invited to perform in that space or show in that space, or whatever, and that just holds no interest for me. So I learned a long time ago, when I was working at Hallwalls in the kind of the heyday of performance art, as there was a lot of talk about performance art as the new vaudeville, and that there was going to be, this was going to, you know, there'd be this circuit of spaces that people could perform in, and they could move up, you know, this kind of evolutionary ladder from playing spaces, to use local examples, from you know, say the vault that currently exists right now, to say Squeaky Wheel, and then from Squeaky Wheel to Hallwalls, and then from Hallwalls to the Birchfield Penny, and from the Birchfield Penny to the Albright, like these hierarchies. And there was a period when people thought that that was really going to happen, and for a few people it really did happen, but for the vast majority it was nothing like that. I know lots of people who will perform at a space like you know, the Birchfield one night, and then the next night they're doing a benefit, or they're just doing something that they love doing at the vault, and then, you know, they might get invited to do something at the Albright Knox, but that doesn't mean that they'll never do these other spaces. You know, that hierarchy just completely fell apart. And as far as a national circuit, a lot of those spaces closed in the 90s, and so that didn't become an option. So, and that doesn't really bother me. I feel totally comfortable with that. I like the fact that I can do absolutely nothing for seemingly years at a time, and then have like a little mini wave of things happening, and then nothing for a while. I'm not the kind of artist that's driven to be constantly producing and to be moving ever higher up that evolutionary ladder. I love it that, you know, there are little flukes where I get to do something in front of a large number of people briefly, or I get a certain amount of attention for a while, and then nothing for a long periods of time. Doesn't bother me at all. And that's very different than that show business model that I was first talking about with Johnny Carson, and, you know, that whole notion of stand-up comics, you know, you play Carson, and then you get to do this, and you get to do that, and it's like you're awarded all of these possibilities with it. That part of the showbiz model doesn't hold any appeal for me at all. It just doesn't work. Unless you're extremely lucky or extremely driven.
What are some of your needs as an artist that the larger community can provide?
You know, when I read that question, I thought, this is kind of in danger of perpetuating the sense that artists need something from the society, when in reality, I don't think that I need anything from other people. I mean, I can come up with a different answer to that, but my gut response is, I should be thinking more about what kinds of resources I can share with the community around me, not what people owe me. I don't think that anybody owes artists anything. It's an artist's job to take whatever resources they have at hand and to make something with those. I mean, that makes me think about the aesthetic of the blockbuster movie, say, versus the independent film. When I was in college, I saw a whole bunch of film noir, kind of like B movies from the 1940s and 50s, and they were made on a shoestring budget. And I was always blown away by those. And this is the exact moment in our culture when movies started costing more and more to make and needing more and more resources. And I have never once thought, God, if only I had, you know, $200 million, I could really get my vision out there. It's more like, gee, you know, with $20, you can do incredible things. And I'm always way more impressed with people who can do a lot with very little than, you know, do a little with a whole lot.
What would help advance your artistic career? Think about that in terms of yourself. You know, mm-hmm. Don't think about that in
right.
following anything that's
right.
not true to your vision. But where do you see yourself going with this and going next and moving on to?
Well, I'll tell you things that would help out in a big way. I've been saying this for years about performance, is it has no kind of backing infrastructure. All the other arts have publications, they have communities of people, and this is changing a little bit. As I say this, I'm thinking that the internet is changing this a little bit, because I've seen some performance related blogs, and I've seen people writing about things finally. That's so desperately needed, to have an audience to have a genuine community that consists of audience members, performers, and a lot of those people are the same people. You know, you're a performer one night, you're an audience member the next night. to have that kind of community is really important. Buffalo, one of Buffalo's tremendous blessings is that it isn't really wrapped up in tight genres. Like, what I love about this place is that you'll find a visual artist whose best friends are sculptors, and they love, you know, their friends are writers, and you know, the writers are all involved with video artists and so forth. Like, there aren't those rigid categories, and I've looked for it in other arts communities around the country, and I haven't seen that as much. I don't see it in New York, I don't see it in LA or San Francisco. It's a thing that happens that's unique to Buffalo. Having said that, it would be nice if there were a kind of more of a if there were more focus on performance, if there were people to talk to. Like, there's a community of painters, say, that can go and do studio visits and things like that. It's not really quite the same thing. You need a critical mass in whatever medium that you're working in, and you need I could use that, I guess. I could use a lot more of that. That's the one thing that I would really want.
What advice do you have for emerging artists within the performance field?
Oh, that's very simple. Don't be afraid to make mistakes. Just go out there, do whatever your passion is, and don't worry about what it's going to look like, how cool you're going to seem, how uncool you're going to be. Just do it, and let the chips fall where they may. One of the performance that I learned more from than any other was one that I did with my friend James Bergeron, I was mentioning earlier, where we did this incredibly elaborate production, and we spent, you know, weeks, months putting this thing together, and it went over like a lead balloon. Half of the audience walked out on it. It just didn't work. And I am so thankful for that experience, much more than for things that work really well. Because if something works really well, people just come up to you later and say, oh, that was really great, but they're not very specific about it. We knew exactly, you know, what was going wrong and why and when and so forth, because we could just watch it. And there were mistakes that I made in that style of work that I just vowed never to make again. And you only learn those lessons if you are brave enough, I guess, to just make a fool of yourself. If you're still making a fool of yourself after, you know, 30 years, then we may need to talk about that. But no, that's okay. I mean, try things out. Don't have so much of the finished product in mind. And that's, oh my God, that's another, I hadn't thought of this until now, but the key thing that I hear all the time from especially younger, it's pretty much younger performers, is planning things in advance, is we're going to do this to the audience, or the audience is going to, you know, the audience is going to respond in this way to this, or, you know, this is what's going to happen. And you can't predict what's going to happen with an audience, because the audience is not a unified body that's the same every time. You may have all these grand notions about what the audience is going to do, but when you get your specific audience, they may respond in a completely different way, and you have to be open to what that is. This is more true, I guess, of live performance, but I think it's applicable to any art form, to not have a kind of condescending attitude in regard to, you know, who's going to be seeing your work. Keep in mind that the people that are going to be seeing your work are at least as smart as you are, if not generally smarter than you are. And so you're not going to, you know, this is not 1890. You're not going to be shocking them. You're not going to be changing their lives by disgusting them or whatever. It just doesn't work. People now, and people ever since about 1920 or so, just if they go to that kind of performance, they say, oh, yes, I'm supposed to be shocked now. That's the only response that you get. Either that, or it just doesn't register at all. It just, you know, flies over people's heads. Don't assume what the audience is going to do until the audience is actually there, and then you can't make any assumptions. You have to play off of that.
Is there anything that you wish you knew when you were starting your career as a writer and a performer that you know now?
No. I had a lot of trouble figuring out the difference between that question and the earlier one, because I would say to myself, don't be afraid to make mistakes. I think realistically, the thing that I would say to myself right now, to young Ron Emke, is be as brazen in getting your work out there, even though you find it distasteful. Go ahead and do it. It doesn't hurt to follow through on connections. Like, you spend all this time making connections, so you may as well follow through on them. And it isn't the end of the world to kind of talk your work up. I mean, it's so much easier for me to be self-deprecating than to be, you know, self-promoting, partly because I just don't like self-promoting people, and most of my friends are self-deprecating, so I feel right at home with them. But it's okay. I've also, one thing I've learned working in the press, which is something that we haven't talked about, but, you know, kind of make my living writing about other people's work, is don't be afraid to talk up your work to the local media, because they need you as much as you need them. You want publicity for your, you know, and I know this question should be about myself, but I, you know, it's about other people as well. You've got an exhibition coming up, you've got a reading coming up, you've got a performance coming up. Don't be afraid to pick up the phone and get to know the person who works at the local newspaper, the local magazines, local anything. Establish a personal relationship with them and tell them about your work. And again, be brazen about this, because they need you. Now, and they also have pretty good bullshit detectors. So there's a word for your AJ file. But they have pretty good detectors built in that will tell them if you've gone too far. And hopefully you have a similar sense of self-awareness. But it's no crime to kind of say to people whose job is to talk about what's going on in the community, to tell them, here is something that's going on in the community that you should know about and that your readers should know about.
Well, Ron, thank you so much for coming into the Birchfield Penny Arts Center to participate in the Living Legacy Project.
Well, it's an honor.